We're calling this Opus 1 today. Opus 2 will be presented tomorrow. But when Ryan Haskins contacted me, it was just too great of an opportunity to pass up. So we're doing a live presentation today. First of all, Ryan Haskins, music director and conductor of the Sioux City Symphony Orchestra. Welcome.
Maestro. Thanks, Gretchen. Good to be here.
Do you believe we are at the end of the season?
I do not believe, but people tell me we are, so I have to trust them. Yes, it's hard to imagine.
And it's a big week. We have Symphony Gala Saturday night at the Sioux City Courthouse, and tonight is the Partners' Dinner. And then let it never be said the symphony does. We know how to have a party, and we're going to go out with a bang.
That's right. Yeah, and like everything, at least we try to sort of tie it all together. We started this year with Star Wars, and we end back in space here in April. It's going to be really a wonderful, wonderful evening ahead at the concert. We have so many different elements that are being brought together. And I have to say, just like most of the designs that either are purposeful or not, they sort of all blend beautifully together and work off of each other. Each one of these works on this program. So it's going to be a thrilling night, and I think something that the audience is really going to take to.
And at the concert Saturday night, we'll be getting a glimpse of the upcoming season for next year.
Yeah, we around this time, we can barely keep our lips sealed, but with all of the excitement that sort of lies behind the next season, the upcoming season, but we'll be announcing that here on the weekend, and I can't wait for some of these programs to come up and also to, of course, share them with the public.
And we're very excited because we have Hillary Purrington here from New York City. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome.
Thank you.
She is the eighth composer of the year. And Ryan, maybe you could talk a little bit about how you developed this concept, what the criteria is for picking composer of the year.
Well, when I first came to Sioux City, in fact, I hadn't even had the job. It was at my audition. I tell this story a lot, but I think it's important. At my audition concert, I was gathering in one of the receptions afterwards, and a person came up to me and said, you know, the concert was great, had so much fun, loved what you did, musicians sounded so wonderful. So if you get the job, I need to make sure that you sort of know our take on music. I said, okay, interesting conversation. I'll listen. and then she proceeded to tell me that you know, they had this sort of horrible experience with new music a couple years previous. Well, long story short, I found out that the couple years previous was 10 years before, and the work that she was talking about was Igor Stravinsky's Firebird. So I knew that if I did, in fact, get the job, that I would have a challenge ahead. Not anything against this woman. She was very honest and very engaged and very knowledgeable of symphonic repertoire. But I knew things perhaps needed to look in different directions for inspiration and how that program comes together. And it doesn't all have to be Mozart and Beethoven and Brahms. So early on, I knew that I needed to sort of slowly tip the cart into a new world that allowed us to explore not only Stravinsky, but works beyond sort of the norm, because that's our role as orchestras, and I think especially here in America, it's also our role to promote composers, American composers. I think we need to do it a lot more than we're doing right now. So that's our goal. So early on, we said, let's do this competition. So we have a call for scores that goes out we're now up to just about 150, I think, applications a year, between 100, 125, 150, depending on the year. We have the difficult decision then of going through all of these applications and deciding who is best fit for that year. And it can depend on programming, it can depend on where we are as a community, what we've had in the year. as far as other works, how they complement or how they challenge the other repertoire. So it's a variety of things. And also the importance of the composer being able to communicate is really important. And so we interview our finalists on the phone, talk to them, make sure they can speak about their music and their motives and their ideas and their concepts. Because a big part of this competition is the outreach. And so Hillary, as she, I'm sure, will share, is busy. The few hours that she is here starting today, we just came from East High's AP theory class, and the schedule will not really let up until those final notes of the concert on Saturday night. So it's something that's important to us, that education, development, and promotion of young American composers, and Composer of the Year program here in Sioux City is something where we sort of keep on the top of our list as one of our signatures.
Well, I was just so thrilled and intrigued by Hillary's resume, very impressive. And for our listeners, Hillary is originally from Massachusetts. She's living in New York City, and she was educated at the Yale School of Music, Juilliard, and the Shepherd School of Music at Rice University. It's so very wonderful to meet you and have you here today, Hillary. Well,
thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Intrigued by some of the compositions that you've written. You're also a vocalist.
Yes.
Before we get to your body of music, talk a little bit about your introduction to music growing up and what led you to become a composer.
Sure. Well, growing up, I played piano. That was an important part of my life. And then in high school, I started singing. And sophomore year of high school, I took AP Music Theory at my high school. And the first half of the year was spent preparing for the AP exam, and the second half of the year was spent on just analysis and composition. So we would look at a piece of music, analyze it, and the assignment was to write our own version of it. And I did this, and the course was taught by my chorus teacher. Her name's Kayla Worlin. She noticed that I was good at writing. So she asked me to arrange a piece for one of her choirs, which I did. And after that, she asked me to try composing a new work for it. And I spent the summer between sophomore and junior year doing that. And we performed it my junior year. And I ended up writing another piece for a different choir in my high school senior year. So a lot of it was just because I had a teacher who was invested in my musical growth and saw potential there and really encouraged me to explore and try things. And from there, junior year, or the summer between junior and senior year, I went to Interlochen Arts Camp. And there, that was important for me because I needed to find out if I could live in that space of just creating music and being around musicians. I needed to know if that was a place that was for me. And I found out it was. And from there, I applied to programs in music composition, and I ended up going to the Shepherd School at Rice University for my undergrad.
Well, been looking at your information that Ryan sent me, and you're as comfortable composing chamber and vocal music as you are orchestra music. But what really stands out to me are some of these pieces of music you've composed. Can you talk about the relationship between composition and dance? I mean, you're working with some very well-known choreographers around the country. Can you talk about how that relationship works?
I love collaborating with other people, and part of collaborating, especially with choreographers who may or may not have, you know, a solid background in music, part of that is establishing a language. Because for me, I'm not a dancer, and the choreographer usually isn't a musician, and we have to figure out how we can effectively communicate. Because if we can't communicate, that's frustrating, you know? I need to know what her goals are, and she needs to know, like, what my goals are and what, you know, what we're both capable of. So that's something that takes a lot of practice, I think, and a lot of experience, knowing how to communicate with someone who doesn't have that background and how to build that foundation.
And you have written a song cycle. I really want to hear about this. talking about the devastating effects of climate change. You called it a clarion call, and it was presented at a conference.
Yes. So in 2015, I won a grant from the Eric Stokes Foundation to write a piece about climate change. So I tried to take a lot of contemporary texts from the news, from speeches, and I wanted to focus on the Marshall Islands specifically because they are already experiencing those effects. There have been devastating floods, and a lot of citizens have been thinking about the future and whether they can even remain there, which is terrifying that they have to consider leaving their homeland for this reason and go someplace completely different and pursue a completely different way of life. So I really wanted to express that and write about that, and also write about the reactions of climate change deniers, I would say. And when you pair these texts together, it's very effective. It shows very different perspectives and where priorities are.
We were talking, communicating through email, and you had sent me a very long list of female composers. I assume these are women who have inspired you. Perhaps you've worked with some of them or have gone to school with some of them?
Some of them, yes. And a lot of them I don't know or don't know personally. One of the composers I sent, Rena Esmail, she also went to Yale, but we did not overlap. But her music is particularly special to me because I actually had an opportunity to perform it. While I was at Yale, I sang with Yale School of Cantorum, which is their professional choir, and my second year they had commissioned an oratorio from her. So it was for Baroque orchestra and choir, and it was a 40-minute work, and it has become one of my absolute favorite pieces. And as a musician, as a performer, it was probably one of the most fulfilling experiences I've ever had. So she was primarily trained in Western music, but in recent years she has pursued training in Hindustani music and vocals. So she was working those influences into the piece, and it's incredibly effective, and it's honest as well. It's very much part of her musicianship and her voice at this point in time. And that's something I very much admire, that she has worked so hard to learn this other tradition and incorporate it into her own body of work in a meaningful way.
As we look back in history, I was trying to think of a lot of women composers, and I really could only come up with, Clara Schumann, and she was quite well known as a performer, and Fanny Mendelssohn. But why is it that women were so overshadowed? I mean, they certainly had talent and ability, but at that time, we rarely talk about that today.
I mean, for a long time, classical music was like a man's sphere. That wasn't a place where women were welcome. And I mean, I think that exists in, many parts of our culture, not just music. And women just weren't encouraged to compose. I recently finished a biography of Alma Mahler, and that was fascinating for many reasons. But She wanted to be a composer, and she struggled to find teachers. She struggled to find encouragement, and I think that persisted for a long time.
And there are a couple of films that feature. I can't remember them off the top of my head, but I'm certainly a great talent. And she was married to Mahler, and then she married an artist.
Gropius.
Gropius, and then she passed away.
No, they divorced.
And yeah, there's another one?
Franz Werfel, oh. Yeah.
My goodness.
And he died.
Oh, okay. So tell us about your piece of music that you have composed and created for the Sioux City Symphony Orchestra.
I'm really excited about it. It's called Above the Last Cloud, and I was thinking about the other music on the program, and I really wanted to compose something that was lighter and more spirited and had definite direction and that kind of told like a musical story. And so that's what I was thinking about throughout the piece. And I hope I did that. It was an interesting process for me because I had a relatively short amount of time to write it. So it was a fun challenge. It was a challenge.
Yeah, we don't normally, with our composer of the years, they usually submit works. And 7 times out of 8, we take the work that is submitted. But with Hillary, it was something that both Clint Needham, who has helped with the competition and who continues to sort of help me file through all of the applications that we get and organize them in some way that we can think about them intelligently, we thought that this would be a perfect opportunity for a commission because we believe so much in Hillary's language and the way that she was able to share her musical thoughts through her composition. We thought this would be the opportunity to actually commission one of our composers of the year. We, of course, do commissions throughout our seasons, but this is a sort of fun opportunity and I think really exciting opportunity that we get to actually premiere this work on Saturday night. So it's going to be great.
Is it modern, post-romantic, something in between?
Perhaps. I don't really like labels.
Okay.
But there are melodies, if that's helpful. I'm a singer, so I love melodies. I love singable things. And especially when writing for any instruments, I always think about writing singable lines. Because for me, if it's singable, then it's tunable. Because I feel like when something is difficult to sing, that also means for the performer, it's difficult to tune on their instrument. So I try to think practically, like,
that's interesting.
What's going to work well for this, you know, for the musician themselves? Like, are they going to enjoy this? Is this, you know, will this work for them?
And that dialogue is, excuse me, that dialogue is very important, not only for the musicians in rehearsal, while we work through this brand new work, which, you know, the greatest composers through that rehearsal process sometimes have adjusted things we may not need to. We may need to look at a little thing here or there, not rewrite the work completely, but just make adjustments, whether in dynamics or just a little more, you know, it could be a small handful of things. But the other part of this dialogue is with the audience, and that's part of the reason why this program is so important, is that we actually bring a living, breathing composer to town. And to actually speak not only to the community, but Hillary will also be on stage Saturday night before her piece is performed to speak about it. So, you know, that's an important educational aspect. Again, we don't sort of categorize education into a school building. There's an enormous duty that we have to educate everyone. And I think that element in programs, as you've seen in the past years with the Sioux City Symphony, the element of education is crucial and on point, hopefully, with almost every work that we're performing. So the audience doesn't feel like they have to go to 10 years of conservatory, or maybe they have. But my hope is that all of those people, still able to take their own experience out of the concert, also have sort of just a clued in moment of where we are, what the composer was thinking, or what the idea was, or this is what this motive is, or that theme is. And I think that adds to the success of a great evening at the symphony.
Can you talk about composition in what's the process for someone like me? I have absolutely no idea what it takes, you know, what inspires you. How do you get to the end of actually writing a piece of music?
Sure. Well, usually I have a set of guidelines given to me to begin with. So I have instrumentation, I have length, usually some other things as well. So I have some parameters within which I can work. And that's always the best place to start. It's a lot harder when everything's open-ended and you have to make those decisions from the beginning. And then oftentimes it's the people themselves, the people I'm working with. If I know people within the ensemble to begin with, that is sometimes helpful as well. If I know their playing style or what they're good at, that's helpful. And then from there, I start writing. And usually what I do is I write the very beginning of the piece. I write the opening, the first thing that everyone's going to hear. That's what I like to think about. And then after that, I stop. I write how I want it to start, and then I stop. And then I think about the rest of the piece and how that's going to unfold. And then I like to draw, so I will draw a sketch of the entire piece. It'll be kind of like a timeline of how things will happen. And I think about proportions and how I want things to unfold. And sometimes I stick with it and sometimes I really don't. It depends. But that's usually the process. I come up with the opening and decide how the rest of the piece will unfold.
Well, much like a painter or a writer creates a work, is it hard to stop? I mean, are you tempted? Do you know when it's exactly the way you want it? Or do you go back and is it a tweaking process? Or
I think there are always improvements to be made. There's a point at which the music itself is done. And then, yeah, there are all those little details, like little orchestrational things, little details to add to, you know, just really tighten things up and brighten it. It's hard to know when it's actually done. And sometimes the deadline just determines that. It's like, okay, well, I have a draft. It's done. It's time to send it in.
During this process, are you so absorbed in the composition that you're hearing it, you're dreaming about it at night, you're thinking about it, you're eating it for breakfast? I mean, does it just consume you?
In many ways, yes. I do get my own music stuck in my head a lot. And in some ways, it's a good thing. Like, I realize, like, oh, the piece is in a good place if it's, you know, stuck in my head like this. And sometimes it's a little bit obnoxious. But yes, that happens a lot. And I am thinking about the piece a lot and what's going to happen. And then it kind of colors my experience of other concerts as well. I'm sitting there and I'm like, oh, like that was an excellent thing that I just heard. Can I use this? Can I incorporate this in any way? That happens as well. And I'm, you know, perceiving things around me in the context of this piece.
We have a little bit of music if you'd like to set this up for us. This is a composer, you know, in New York.
Rena?
Yes.
Yes. She is based in LA now.
LA.
And
okay.
She is a wonderful composer. Like I said, I had the privilege of singing a piece of hers with the Yale Schola Cantorum 2 years ago. And she's also just a wonderful person. I admire what she's doing as a composer, as an educator, what she's doing through outreach, and I admire her as a musician. So
Steve, we're going to hear a bit of music now by Rena. Thank you, Steve. If you're just joining us, we're in studio with Ryan Haskins, music director and conductor of the Sioux City Symphony Orchestra, and our composer of the year, Hillary Purrington. And that was a very interesting piece of music. I heard in some indigenous Indian music, perhaps, certainly in the vocal mm-hmm. part of that. Do you want to comment?
Sure. So it was for Hindustani vocalist and then traditional Western instruments. So last year, Rina had a piece premiered with the Albany Symphony, and it was for Hindustani vocalist and traditional Western vocalist. And it was basically about a dialogue between the two. And it was essentially like a concerto for the two voices. And it's an incredible piece, but what was amazing was to see like how the audience really responded to it. It really like reached everyone there. And at the end of the piece, the entire audience just like leapt to their feet. And it's just amazing to see how audiences are so receptive to this kind of music that brings in influences from other cultures, that introduces them to sounds that they may not have heard before. And when it comes from this honest place, it's so well received, and it really communicates something special.
Well, just that little bit makes me want to hear more of that piece. That was really remarkable. And it's fascinating to me when a Western classically trained composer, musician, vocalist, whatever, veers off into this whole other realm of music, non-Western music. That's fascinating. That's beautiful. Ryan, we should get back to you for a few minutes.
It's okay. I'm enjoying this.
This is wonderful. What are some of your thoughts of this past season? I would like to know a little bit about maybe concerts that were especially special to you in some way, or something you would like to do differently next time, or can you give us kind of a synopsis?
Right. So I think this year, a couple of things we could sum up. I think, moving into this season, as I tell the orchestra quite frequently, and for great, there's a great purpose for that. I think there's the right time to perform certain works with a certain ensemble. Not only just for the ensemble's well-being, but also for the community and for the listening audience. And I would say that this season has really tuned into those, those airwaves on the musician side, on the orchestra side, and what we need as the listening community here. And so works, that we've been able to feature this year, I think, tick those boxes. I've been waiting to do, for example, some of these larger works. I've been waiting to do the Rachmaninoff Symphonic Dances for years. I've been waiting to do another Strauss tone poem with the orchestra for years. It comes down to scheduling, getting the specific artists that are featured. That doesn't just happen overnight and we complete the deal the day before they get here. For some of these artists, it requires years of planning. And that certainly is the case for next year's artists. There are at least, actually, every guest artist next year, I have been waiting over 3 years to have here in Sioux City. And usually that's just because of scheduling. But it is exciting when you can arrive at these moments when the schedule works, the right repertoire works, and we're right in that sort of right wave of time. So for example, when we arrived at February's program with the Amadeus Experience, which was probably one of the most involved programs I've ever done out here in Iowa, for a couple of different reasons. One, programming 13 plus works of Mozart, only a small amount of them known and the rest unknown, but sort of along the lines of these landmarks in his life. That's a great idea, but it involves a whole heck of a lot of work just to have the idea and the concept of, all right, here's a man who, yes, only lived 35 years, but there's so much to talk about and so much music to choose. So it really took me a year to sort of finalize what we were actually going to do on that program. And then also what the audience needs. We're starting to adventure into this world of how media plays into concert programs, specifically on the classical side. And I think it's important to acknowledge it. Art has to evolve. If art stays the same all the time, eventually it gives out. So it has to evolve with the time. with the times. And I think that is a really important conversation to have when it comes to media, when it comes to, you know, projections or visuals or any element that adds to the program, not to detour or to take away from the music that's being performed, but to highlight and to bring to a whole new experience, because that's what we're really focused on in Sioux City, is the ultimate concert experience. It sounds a bit like a rock show, but it really is, because you think, you look back in time and some of those great epic programs that we look back in the history books of, you know, Beethoven's, I don't know, however long, 4 hour or 5 hour concert, or, you know, these epic programs that we read back about, you know, that may seem crazy to us, then why would you ever want to sit back? But it was an experience for that audience that most likely they didn't really realize that it was so, so long. And all of these composers have these sort of moments in their career when they were marked by the experience in the concert hall. And there's nothing wrong with overture concerto symphony programs, but I think there can be more in programming, and that's what we're doing as we evolve and move forward into the next season. Something else that we are doing next season, we're featuring on every classical program some element of a female composer, which I think is exciting. We have not done that enough, and that's me. That's my decision. And so that element is something I'm really excited about, and hope that we maintain that element of that mix. And, you know, there are some ridiculously talented female artists that we just need to think about more and be an influence more, and actually experience, and then sit back and think, where have I been? Here's this music, or here's this performer, and I never even realized. And those are, again, those elements and experiences that we provide here. And so I hope that the community is as excited as we are as we move into this next season. Wonderful anniversaries we'll be celebrating with composers as well. This wrapping up my 10th year here is really something incredible, to look back on the years and see how we have, in fact, evolved. And also very appreciative of the trust the community has given to an organization where you essentially buy a ticket and maybe not really know what you're going to expect when you show up to the concert hall. There's a risk there. I would never be able to do that with a community that doesn't believe in it or doesn't trust it. But that belief is there and the trust is there, so that only drives the creative energy to creating these epic concert experiences.
Well, I'm especially happy to hear about the female composer of the year. I think that's something we very much need to do, and I support you in all of those endeavors, as you know, Ryan, and I have always appreciated the outreach that you do and the many opportunities we have to talk about music right here on public radio, and the way that you are out there and reaching out to new audiences, and especially children.
Yeah, it's something we experienced even this morning at the high school. You know, it's nothing about this is any different from when we talk about bringing guest artists to town. You know, it's one thing to bring an incredibly talented and technically perfect guest artist to town. Orchestras do that all the time. But there's an extra element that I feel like we take really special care to, and that is an amazing, equally amazing communicator, not just from the stage, but I want to bring good people to town, people who have something to share. It doesn't necessarily mean that they share the same ideas or thoughts, but even more energizing when they can bring a new element or cause you to have that sort of shock effect to think, gosh, I never even considered that. Here I am, you know, 40 years supporting an orchestra, and I just learned something brand new or experiencing something brand new. And that's what someone like Hillary is able to do for us. You know, Hillary, as you have gone down her lists and lists of accolades, has experienced so much as a young person. That's not disrespectful, is it? I can call you a young person. We're all young people at this table. But But the ability to communicate and share and energize. I mean, you should see the faces and the questions that came from these high schoolers this morning. And again, you know, we run across the road here after we're done with you in a few minutes to the Lifelong Learning Program, where we share with a new energy, a new spirit that that feeds this exactly what it should be about art and culture. And that is what makes us good, what drives us into these new worlds of building us up, whether we're 15 years old or we're 105 years old. Out of all these experiences, we grow. We're strengthened by these moments. Even if the moment may be 30 minutes, we're strengthened and influenced by these remarkable, uplifting moments in art. And that's something that Hillary and I get to live in every day. We're so lucky to be able to call it our careers.
Well, Hillary, I was thinking about a year ago, and we had West Side Story here, mm-hmm. and that was amazing. And Ryan brings this sense of what's happening elsewhere. He somehow manages to kind of create these special programs right here in Sioux City. So, and I think people get that what is happening here isn't happening in all the, you know, Midwest orchestras and markets, but it really takes, I'm not expressing this very well, but it really does take someone who's brilliant and very tuned in the musical circles around the globe. And this is just another example of something really exceptionally wonderful for Sioux City to experience Composer of the Year, you, Hillary.
Perhaps I'd be interested to hear from Hillary about how she, you know, we've talked a bit about your influences, mm-hmm. but as someone who's sort of climbing up the ranks, you know, whether it was through your degrees or whether it's after post degrees, though sometimes those times are even more interesting, how those influences have taught you, you know, we all have amazing teachers we look back on, and each, I think, brings us some new sort of tool for the toolbox. I wondered if you could just talk about some of those influences and how that shaped you to where you are right now in your career.
Absolutely. First, I want to address like the importance of having female role models as a female composer. So when I was in high school, my high school chorus teacher, she's the one who really encouraged me to try composing. And then I spent a summer at Interlaken Arts Camp where my private composition teacher, Roshan Edizadi, was also female. So from the beginning, it didn't seem strange to me that I was a young woman pursuing composition. And then when I went to Rice, my first teacher there was Shui Chen. And I've been very lucky to have powerful, exceptional female role models as a musician. And that just shows why it's important to have diversity in classical music, because it's important to have people to look to. And I've been extremely lucky. And who knows if I would be composing if I hadn't been influenced by them and their teaching. I have had some extraordinary teachers, and what was interesting about my time at Rice was that we switched teachers every year or every semester, even if you wanted. So I had a variety of powerful influences. I wasn't assigned to one studio where I stayed for 4 years. That does happen at a lot of conservatories, and you know there are strengths to that model as well. But I feel lucky in the sense that I really had a lot of exposure to different perspectives and different techniques. So I left undergrad with a solid technical foundation, which is really important as a composer, especially as a professional composer, because when you're given a set of parameters, as I was saying earlier, when someone asks you to create a certain work, you have to have the technique to sit down and be able to create something that functions and functions well within those parameters. And technique is what supports that. I feel like it's something that composers don't speak about often, and it's certainly not a question we get. I mean, we're always asked, like, oh, what inspires you? And inspiration is important as well, but it's also important, equally so, to have a good technical foundation. And I was very lucky to have that and to have teachers who taught that way. I still study with Chris Theofanides, and he is one of my favorite composers, favorite people, favorite teachers. And I've been lucky to have advocates as well. And one thing I've discovered, I graduated from Yale in 2017, and when you leave school, you discover exactly what your family is, what your support system is. And I've been lucky to find out that I have a very strong support system. I have many advocates. I have many friends who want me to do well and are advocates for me and my music. And that's been important to realize and important to, you know, cultivate those connections as well.
I think it's interesting, you know, this is the sort of behind the curtain concept of, for people who are not musicians or not composers or conductors or orchestral players, you know, it may be sort of the mystery of, okay, I go to the concert, I hear their music, or I see them conduct, or I see them play. All right, that's 2.5 hours. All right, then what else is there? And I think, you know, you talk about the balance. I mean, it is interesting. I don't want to turn this into like, you know, a whole confessional kind of situation. But I think it is fascinating that each one of us artists must find the balance. There is a balance. And whether it has to do with our craft or not, it affects our craft, right?
Right.
And the balance of family. What is family? Whether it actually is a family, whether it's a partner, whether it's children, whether it's, you know, your living situation or whatever, those aspects influence us. You know, that's
not on your bio, right? That's
not something you talk about in your bio. But it plays a really important part into becoming who we are and then translated into what an audience actually experiences. And I think it's interesting to do that. You know, it's another element to looking at influences as teachers, but how we carve out our lives we talked about the real world at the high school today.
Yes.
it lives and breathes music every single second of our lives, but we have to function as human beings as well. And it's not easy. It's not easy. There are challenges to that. You know, if you have family and you're career is about traveling. You know, you're composing for orchestras around the world, or you're a guest soloist at, you know, 17 orchestras in 2 months or 3 months or whatever the number is. That lifestyle can be difficult. But I think it is, I don't know, just a new element to think about, and realizing that this art is all about the human. Whether some composers like to admit that or not, because some composers don't.
Some composers don't. That's
yeah.
true.
Yeah.
And music, it's all about humans. I mean, for me, I'm writing for a person to play a piece which will be heard by people. And it's important to think about all the people involved at every stage of the process, because it is a collaborative effort. And I want everything to go as smoothly as possible. I want to be able to communicate as clearly as possible. And that's something I think about throughout the writing process and as I'm presenting my music to others.
And that's the brilliance to a project like this, is that we get to have Hillary, you know, the orchestra will play through the work a time or two. But then when the composer comes to town, then it sort of takes on its life. And it may not involve any conversation. But for me, whenever I get to present a work with a composer in there, at least for a rehearsal, if not a couple, something happens, something else happens. Whether it's affirmation that we're heading in the right direction or new discovery. You know, I've had composers come up in places even outside of Sioux City, and we sit down and brand new work, we play through it. And I talk to the composer afterwards and I say, well, how was it? And they say, it was nothing. It wasn't like anything I thought it was going to be. And then I think to myself, oh God, what have I done? And then they say, no, it was great. So that kind of, those types of things happen. And that's okay. And, you know, we experience that in you know, collaborative, you know, with guest artists too. I mean, there's no better feeling when you have someone who concertizes and who's been doing it for 40, you know, 30, 40 years, and you sit down to a performance and then you experience something brand new for them. that they played that concerto or whatever it is 200 different times, and the 201st time is completely new and different. That's exciting. It's something we're experiencing in this, you know, in the state. We have over 90 musicians for the Strauss work, right, on stage. I'm barely holding onto the edge of the stage with the podium falling off. There are so many people on the stage. But again, it's an element of bringing all of those personalities of everyone into one space, having all the complexity of the composition in front of us, and somehow journeying through a massive work. I mean, it is this human experience that sort of shapes these monumental moments in music, which I think is, you know, it's easy to get bogged down with the stresses and strains in preparation with these types of things, but it really can be a magical experience. Really can.
That's just the word that I was going to use, magical. Yeah. And I'm really looking forward to hearing your composition tomorrow. Excuse me, Saturday.
Thank you.
I'm supposed to mention that Steve Smith will be giving a pair of tickets away to the Sioux City Symphony Orchestra, its final concert of the season, Out of This World. And it really is going to be out of this world. Mm-hmm. The Strauss, Hillary's piece. What else is on the program?
We have two works also by Mason Bates, who is also going to be here. So we have three wonderful people in town. Mason Bates, composer and DJ who we've had a couple of times in Sioux City, and the great mezzo-soprano Sasha Cook will also be here. And of course, Hillary. The first two pieces on the program are Mason's works. The first is Alternative Energy, which is a sort of this energy symphony made up of four movements, and we travel. We start in sort of the Midwest junkyards of Henry Ford's automobile. So there are car parts being played on and metal sheets and all these sort of abnormal percussion section moments. And we travel through time through this amazing sort of tour de force. I think it actually is one of the works that sums up Mason's writing the best. I think he would agree with me too. And then the second work on the program is a work called Passage, which was written for Sasha Cook and premiered by the National Symphony in commemoration of the 50th moon landing, a lunar landing, which is in 2019, that 50th anniversary. The work is, the text is taken from the great poem Passage to India by Walt Whitman, and explores the ideas of discovery and innovation and exploration. And Mason takes that text and turns it into this work that highlights the discovery of what it was for the space program and what we had to do through that. And we actually hear excerpts from JFK's actual moonshot speech that Mason extracted from the Library of Congress. So it's sort of this electronic combination and live audio clips from the speech and Sasha out in front of the orchestra singing just these amazing words by Walt Whitman. So it's a really incredible first half. And then we have this beautiful, I can't say it's more perfect. It is so perfect. Hillary's piece, and it falls perfectly into the program. I don't know if I even told you where it did. Did I tell you where it fell in the program?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, so that maybe that's why it works so well. But it's sort of this, I don't know, palette cleanser kind of moment in the program where it sort of brings us back out of this first half and just in time for then the Also Sprach Zarathustra at the end of the program. So I'm very excited. It's a big program, but all of the elements are. I'm over the moon by this all the collaboration and work being put into this program. So,
and Hillary, you're very busy. I see you have a number of other projects that are coming up. Do you want to just quickly mention those?
Yes. So this season, I'm also a composer in residence for Musical Chairs Chamber Ensemble. They're based on Staten Island, and I'm writing a new piece for them, which will be premiered in May. And then I am also writing a piece for C4, a choral ensemble in New York City, and I sing with them as well. And that'll be performed at the end of this month. And I'm excited because I think it's the first time in a long time that I've actually performed one of my own pieces. So that'll be fun. And then I'm also working on a guitar concerto for American Composers Orchestra and Gigi Kim, a brilliant young guitarist. She and I were actually roommates together at Yale, so I knew that if we could live together well, we could collaborate well. So I'm excited to finally be able to write for her, and that'll be a large 20-minute work. It'll be the largest work I have written so far, and that'll be premiered at Carnegie in November. So I'm very excited about that project.
Now, if people want to know more about you or want to follow your music or your career, how can they do that?
I have a website, and that is hillarypurrington.com.
All right. Good to know. And Maestro, we're going to go out with a spectacular piece of music, also Spock Zarathustra by Strauss, which you'll be performing on Saturday night. And I want to thank you for this marvelous opportunity to visit with our Composer of the Year, Hillary Purrington. And always, always a great pleasure. I learn so much from you, Brian Haskins.
It's always great to be here. Thank you, Gretchen. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.